The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
So today's reading, it's kind of there for two reasons. One, the David Partlett reading is to introduce to you this book, which is called The History of Board Games. How many of you read the version from Stellar? Okay. Anyone get the book from the library? Because I think it's on reserve. If you really want to print, read like a, you know, hardback paper version, you could just go to libraries and you should be able to check it out, probably from the Humanities Library. So I'm just letting you know that option's out there. One of the reasons is, one, just to introduce to you a bit of what historical research looks like in game studies. There are people who have careers, like David Partlett, who basically go deep into the history of how some kind of game evolved. One of our own alums, Jason Beggy, he looks at railroad games. I'm pretty sure he hasn't changed his thesis topic yet. Okay. And he's been looking at that for like 3 years now, four?
Yeah, 3 years now.
Yeah. And so they'll go to museums, they'll talk to archaeologists. Well, in the case of railroad games, obviously, there are no archaeologists involved. They'll talk to people who worked on, you know, classic game designs, you talk to retailers, you talk to people who actually owned or played some of these games. And I'm wondering if some of the games, you know, a lot of the games that are written in today's reading were kind of, you know, ancient, really, really ancient games. But how many of you feel like you've actually played a game that sounded like one of those that were written up?
Yeah. Well, explicitly they had Dreidel in there.
Yeah, they had the Dreidel in there. That's what, Purim and Hanukkah? Those are the two festivals? Now it's pretty much just Hanukkah? Okay. It's funny because when I was reading about the Dreidel, I was actually, like the initials, the Great Miracle happened there. I didn't realize that there was a different version for if you play Dreidel in Jerusalem, which is a great thing happened here. Which makes sense for Hanukkah, but I don't think, that doesn't quite make sense for Purim, because
that's
just nothing to do with Jerusalem. Yeah. All right. What else? The other games, the stake board games, or the a lot of these games border on like someone setting up shop on the street, and then as soon as the cops come, you know, they run away. That's one of those kinds of games, right? Let's see. What were some of the other things? They had a lot of lots, and one of the traditional Roman implements was the knuckle bone, right? I'm not quite sure if they mentioned what animal it was. I think it was sheep.
Sheep
or goat? Yeah. But that's where the word alia comes from, and alia comes up quite a bit in game studies, at least since Heusinger's time, since I think the 60s, where it's introduced as a generic term to describe games of chance. I think it might also have the word alia might also have been used like in traditional Latin scholarship to describe games of chance. But that's where you get phrases like alia iacta est, which is, does anyone know what that means?
The die is cast.
The die is cast. It's what Julius Caesar says when he about to cross the Rubicon, famously. And there's originally, you know, there was some confusion about whether that meant the die, like the dice, has thrown, or whether that means that the die, as in the mold for something that you put liquid iron in, and then you cast it. But that's only that still has the same sort of sense. Like, all right, it's out of our hands, right? It's already been done. It sort of gets the same point across. But if you actually look at the Latin, it's specifically talking about these knuckle bones, knuckle bones that you're throwing, that which are called alia. So it's really, now it's up to fate. The book makes, Partlett makes an interesting point that in a way, it's a they're trying to simulate something that seems realistic. That even with your best efforts or with your worst efforts, sometimes certain things are out of your control. And clubs simply just describing them as games of chance might be doing them as a disservice, because you see the same sort of like randomization elements come up in computer games in things like combat, right? You know, especially strategy games, where there's like a chance that something may fail, a chance that something may succeed. And when you think about games like war game simulations, they're obviously not trying to create this fantastic, you know, some sort of fantasy element, unless you're talking about things like Fire Emblem or RPG games. But when talking about like World War II games, something like that, they're trying very, very hard to simulate something that's real. And one of the things that they're trying to simulate is that sometimes you just don't have control over everything. And that's where randomization elements, this particular chapter was about dice and the physical things that you use, and we included spinners, we included things that, you know, that were basically binary, and that's actually a cute idea if anybody wants to think about trying to introduce a bell curve to any of your results without having to having people roll a whole bunch of dice. Or if, you know, rolling two dice gives you numbers from 2 to 16, two to 12, but you wanted a different range, you could just have them roll a whole bunch of flat sticks, and then it lands 1-0, 1-0, and you still get a nice bell curve. So that's an idea that you can use in your games as well. Or you can use things like spinners, which pretty much just give you the equal chance no matter which side you land. And you can make a spinner of arbitrary complexity, right? You could make a 20-sided spinner. It'll look basically like a circle, but you could. But one thing that Partlet also introduces is this idea that that games of chance are also kind of like games of imperfect information. Games of imperfect and perfect information, what's the difference between the two of them? It's the first time we're encountering these terms in this class, but anyone want to hazard a guess? What's an example of a game of perfect information?
Like chess.
Chess. And it's a game of perfect information because?
Because all the information that you're going to be using for your decision-making is right there in front of you.
Right. Players see all the game state. Although Partlet then goes says, but then they don't know, and one of them got out the wrong side of bed that morning. Right, you know. They don't necessarily know how experienced each other is, and that's kind of weird. Is that part of the game, or is that outside of the game, right? And other examples of games of perfect or imperfect information?
Go is a game of perfect information.
Okay, perfect. Which one?
Poker would be imperfect.
Poker will be imperfect because you...
You don't know the deck, you don't know what's in your opponent's hand, stuff like that.
Does poker always have to be played with a single deck of 52 cards?
Five decks. You could even not know how many decks there are.
Okay, you may not know. So that's a question too, right? I mean, typically we play it at home, it's just one deck of cards and 52, and if you know that you're holding a king of spades, there's no other king of spades sitting out there. But you play in certain casinos, you know, and they've got a five deck mix. There could be two kings of spades. There's another hand up there.
Poker.
Okay, yeah. And poker is all about trying to figure out what other people have and what's the chances. Actually, you never really know what other people have, but you're sort of trying to read what's the chances that they've got something, plus what's the chances of your hand beating that. And of course, there's all the variants on poker, like Texas Hold'em and everything, which have other kinds of cards that nobody gets to see, that everyone gets to see. So perfect and imperfect information is kind of like a sledgehammer to deal with this, because you're not quite sure, like random numbers or random cards that you're drawing from a five-card stack or random numbers that you're rolling out of a die is a very, very different quality to that piece of information than a card that somebody is holding and not revealing to everybody else, because that's a fixed quantity. It's something that was dealt in the past, and Partlet describes it as sort of past imperfect information. And then there's future imperfect information. You're going to roll it, and then only then is that information generated, even though no one knew it. No one knows that number. So there's a scholar called Celia Pierce over in Georgia Tech. And she came up with a taxonomy just to help her discuss this with her design teams, and I thought it was really, really useful. So instead of saying imperfect and perfect information, we start off with, you know, the obvious one, which is just public information. Games of perfect information are games of where all information is public. Everything is public information. The state of a board in chess or in checkers. There are probably some computer games where this is the case as well, although like multiplayer computer games, but nothing's coming to mind. A lot of computer games take advantage of the fact that everyone has their own screen to do imperfect information. So when you start jumping into the realm of imperfect information, that's private, which is the stuff that one person, at least one person, knows for sure. Possibly, if you're playing on a team game, there's more than one person who knows this information for sure. If you're playing a game like Bridge, where you're sort of communicating but in codes, you know, if you've been playing with someone for a long time, you can get to the situation where even though I can't see your cards, I pretty much know what cards you have because you're my teammate and you're trying to communicate with me in a way that I understand. That's random information. Which is stuff that you get from, say, drawing from the top of a 5-stack deck of poker cards, or something that you get from rolling a die. You know, stuff that you can't really intuit, what Partlet calls future imperfect. Things that will be sort of, for all intents and purposes, that information is introduced the moment you trigger that randomizing method, the moment you throw the dreidel. Spin. Okay. The moment you throw the knuckle bones, whatever it is, that's the moment where the information gets generated. There may be some probability on how you expect this to work out. Like if you're rolling two dice, you expect number 7 to be the most likely outcome, and number 2 and number 12 to be the least likely outcomes. But that information doesn't really exist until the moment it's generated. So what's missing?
So I'll say something. There's information that's like computable.
Mm-hmm.
That's about there. So for instance, when you're playing cards or something like that.
Yeah.
Sometimes technically that like the rules are like you can't see the rounds that have been played.
Right.
But like there's information which, if you were a computer, you would remember this information.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes, when playing in practice, you can't actually remember.
But the stuff that's hard to remember, let me see if I'm hearing you right. So for instance, the game of blackjack to a card counter is a very different from a game of blackjack for someone who sits down and plays for one round, right? Because the game of blackjack for a card counter is aware that this 5-stack deck of cards has had a certain number of cards played out of it. And knowing, being able to remember how much has been played out of it has changed the actual percentage of what could come out. So what's been played before is technically public information. There were previous rounds that were played out in the open. If you were really, really paying attention, you could have seen that information. It's hard to remember, but you could have. If you were a computer, if you're a videotape recorder, you would have been able to see that information. But then there's all the other cards left in this stack that's already been shuffled, and it's kind of in a fixed order. Well, it was randomized before they shuffled it, and then now it's been shuffled and it's just sitting on a stack. That's what Pierce calls hidden information. It doesn't even have to be like a 5-stack deck. It could be just the 3 cards that were dealt face down at the beginning. Is it 3 cards for Texas Hold'em?
Two?
Okay, the 2 cards that are dealt face down in the center, nobody gets to see that until right at the end, I believe. But they're dealt at the beginning of the game, or like in the second hand, or
the public cards?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
That's
3, right.
Yeah.
And they're down, right?
After
the first round, they get flipped out.
After the first round, they get flipped. Yeah, all right, that's right. That's right, it's been a long time since I played Hold'em. So 3 cards, the face down, but they've been dealt. So the randomizing thing has been triggered. The information is there, but no one knows it yet.
I would argue it's not really different from random information. Like, the difference between, like, I haven't actually dealt the card yet, and I have dealt the card and no one sees it. It seems like hidden information that no one knows is equivalent to random. Hidden information is equivalent to random information.
Not quite. There is a different quality with it, because that variable can no longer change in the rest of the game. Maybe the Texas Hold'em one starts to get a little blurry,
But like random information, like, so you can't treat it any differently. Like, just because, like, if for some reason, like, we've decided that we were like, let's say I wrote a die rolling program, and like, the random seed, and like theoretically, there's no look up what the next random seed was, and so what the next die roll is open. And so you could say this is hidden information, not random information, because the random seed is knows what the next.
If you knew the seed and you knew the randomization algorithm, then I would argue that information is no longer random. That's why they call it pseudo random.
But
it's not actually random anymore.
But it's random in the sense that it's random with regards to the players, so that the players can treat it as random information because they don't know how
you can treat it as random information.
So if you deal two cards out face down from the deck, then at the time when you're dealing the first one, it's random.
Yeah.
But then the first one is a card that's already in play, and so when you take the second one, that card has a smaller space of possibilities. There is a specific card that second one can't be.
There is
the first one.
We don't have to treat it that way.
What I'm saying is that if you want to, if you deal one card and you want to reproduce the exact same situation elsewhere and then continue dealing from the deck, then yeah, the deck might be, maybe you're going to shuffle the deck before you deal a second card. And then that new card is random, the second card, except it's random out of a smaller possibility. And it's not just random because there's hidden information that's affecting what.
That's one other thing that you're not taking into consideration, and that's the fact that before after these three cards in Texas Hold'em are dealt out, face down, no one's got a chance to look at it, but everyone's gotten a chance to see some of the cards that they have been dealt.
Yeah,
and that has already changed the likelihood of what that card could be down,
just because something isn't perfectly uniformly random chosen from like the distribution of everything doesn't mean it's not so random. So like what I'm saying is just because like so if I like deal a face down card and then I throw a face down card into the five of diamonds, it's even though I know that the face down card is not the five of diamonds, it's still random because it's now drawn from the pool of
random
information. Yeah.
I mean, this is perfect Schrodinger's cat, isn't it? Like,
no, it's not, because what happens is that you keep getting new cards throughout the entire game, right? And you know, and these cards slowly get revealed.
I would say that if there's a distinction made between random and hidden for the purposes of this classification of games, there's probably a useful reason for it. And I mean, sure, you can think of it as like now there's dependence between different cards and things like that, but it's probably just there for a useful way of thinking about games.
What I'm saying is I don't think it's useful, and I think it's the statistic that it's useful. I think that, like, there's a difference between the two.
Well, I'm not talking about a statistical difference. I'm talking about what the players think about these three cards. They know these three cards are not being redealt every single hand. They know that no one can say, for instance, like someone can take the deck and shuffle it in the middle of a poker game. No one complains about that. You're allowed to do that. You can't redeal another three cards.
Why not?
You're not allowed to.
It doesn't change the probability
distribution.
It doesn't change the probability distribution, but you're not allowed to. The rules do not allow you to redeal those three cards. There is a different weight that the rules have placed on those three cards that have been dealt, saying those things are now fixed, whereas everything in that deck can be reordered. Your hand and your hand. Yeah.
Well, for like a different example of situation, use like the game Clue, where like you have like the one item, the one person, and the one room.
Right.
That is put away at the beginning, and in some senses it's random, but it's like it determines who wins the game.
Right.
And so in that sense, it's like you wouldn't think of it as random necessarily, and while your dice roll to like move around and discover these things would be random.
And that is actually also a statistically different example, but a much clearer example of hidden information. Because that one, as you play the game, you are getting more and more and more information about what those cards could be. In fact, that's the whole point of the game, right? You know, trying to figure out what's in there. And so in that particular case, that's hidden information that's, you know, random at the point when it was generated. But after that, but as soon as people start playing, start making accusations, it's no longer random. It's just hidden information. So yeah, Clue is a much better example of that. Maybe the three cards in the Texas Hold'em are different. I still maintain that they are qualitatively, they may not be statistically different, but they are qualitatively different because you can never re-randomize those cards according to the rules.
It's just the difference because game players think about, not because they're, the reason the difference is players think about them differently is
like, players, referees.
Like, that's just not true. The cards are down and they're down. You cannot unput them down.
But
so qualitatively, they are completely different.
But at the same time,
from a gameplay standpoint, they're
exactly the
same as if you read he had his hand up first, so let me get to him first, and then we'll get back to you.
So it's actually also statistically different, because let me just simplify the poker example a lot.
Right.
Let's say that we take one card from the deck and put it face down, and then we flip a second card so that everyone sees it.
Right.
And then let's say someone gets it into their head to take that one card that was hidden
right.
and shuffle it back in and deal a new one.
Right.
That actually does, the two situations where you do that and where you don't are different. Because in the first situation, the card that was hidden had a equal probability over all 52 cards. And followed, and when you get one piece, the extra piece of information, after that, your adjusted probability distribution is equal over the 51 cards. However, if you reveal that one card and then take it back, you don't necessarily have that card visible to everyone, for example.
But it's true that the example.
Cards. Do with three cards, it's easy to say.
Yeah. You are describing a situation where someone's actually had a chance to actually look at that card, which has been
face, like,
face down. Yeah, and that does change things because that becomes private information to someone else. So that takes it kind of outside of the realm of examples. but yeah, I do agree that statistically, there's not actually a huge amount of difference between the cards that's face down and the cards that you're drawing off the top of the deck. I'm gonna get your hand and then your hand.
So the problem I have with this is, like, first of all, statistically, there's no difference.
Right.
Not a little difference, there's no difference. And so, like, as a player, mm-hmm. I may sort of, like, think about cards that are fixed a little bit differently than cards that are in the deck, mm-hmm. but, like, if I'm playing to win optimally, I have to, like, think of them as both random.
Sure.
Like, I have to think of them as both probability distributions over cards.
Sure. Strategically, it's probably advantageous for you to think that they're the same statistical difference, because they are.
Right.
And I'm not disagreeing that statistically they have the same likelihood. I'm saying that in terms of how the rules are worded, they're very different.
Okay, so does the use of this definition come in when you're, like, describing rules?
When you're designing the game.
Okay.
Not necessarily when you're playing the game, but when you're designing
the game. I think a useful thing to think about is when we were talking about that Clue example, if you have something that's hidden, you can possibly gain information about it that will be useful, right? You gain information about what that Clue card is. There's no way you're ever going to gain information about what the next roll of the die is going to be unless you're doing, like, some kind of, like, major statistical analysis. And those.
But that's possible. That's theoretically possible. So it's
for a roll of a die, yeah, I mean.
It's still random. There's still a probability distribution over what it is.
Not really.
No. If you're
there's
rolling a die.
I go into that. It's just it's theoretically possible that you could go compute what the die roll is going to be before it's rolled.
Okay. I guess that's
But, there's one very clear example where you can compute it, right? Because you know those dice are loaded. You know, it's like, yeah, you know those dice are loaded, six, and in that particular case, you've got private information, just in the same way that if you're using, say, a pseudo-random number generator.
But if you flip a clue card more than once, it doesn't change. And if you get information about what that is, it stays the same, right?
So I think that the clue example is an example of private information.
No.
It's an example of a combination of private and random information. It's not really like...
No, it's important to remember to note that it's hidden information because no player actually gets to see what that card is.
Yeah.
yes. You when it's inserted into the envelope. And for those people who haven't played Clue, what happens is that you've got a whole stack, you have three different stacks of people, places, and things that you can kill people with from like the 1950s or something. And then you get one, those three decks are shuffled, you pick up one card from each, and those three cards go into an envelope that nobody gets to see until pretty late in the game. And those cards will never change. That's a very clear example of hidden information, because at the point when they were generated, you're right, that was random. But then it gets turned to this piece of hidden information that everyone's trying to find out during the game. The whole point of Clue is that you're trying to figure this out. And there are rules governing who gets to see that hidden information, when. There's rules governing how you generate that information, and there are mechanics for you to be able to figure out what's inside there. Let me see. There was another point that I was going to make about that. And it's true that if you, say, re-implemented that on a computer, or any game that has some sort of randomizing thing in a computer, and you could figure out how the randomizing was being done, because very few things in a computer are like truly random, then you will be able to, say, figure out, okay, the next die roll should be a certain number. The other day I talked about how if you played certain strategy games and you had like a 50% chance of succeeding at something, then technically, if you save the game right before you did that, and you did it, and you kept doing it, then you will eventually have 100% chance of succeeding, right? Because you just keep playing it until you win. Unless it's, of course, it's a pseudo-random number generator that is saving the seed, and so the outcome always turns out to be the same each time. And if you had that information, that's actually private information. The question is that, is that actually going to be something that you're designing into your game, or something that you just choose to live with? And as a designer, you get to make that decision. You get to decide things like, I'm going to save the random number seed when I save a save game. You can decide to reveal what your randomizing scheme is to the rest of the world, and to a hardcore computer hacker, it wouldn't be that hard to figure out what kind of method you're using. You can choose to say, no, this is a very closely guarded secret. You know, I'm actually generating it by, analyzing this Geiger counter, and seeing how, when certain ticks come up, and that's like as close to random as we can get. You can choose to do all of that as a designer, and the question is, where do you want to set those limits for your own game? Things like, for instance, theoretically, a pair of dice can generate any number between 2 and 12. But anyone who's played games for a certain amount of time realizes that 2 and 12 are really rare compared to 7. And there are games that take advantage of that. And there are games who don't take advantage of that. There are some games that basically treat a roll of 12 and a roll of 2 exactly the same as a roll of 7, especially like in a lot of race games. You move that number of steps, but they're not like, but it's not like balanced, so that 2 and 12 are rare, are expected to come up less often or more often. That's why I've seen versions of things like Candyland where they replace the spinner with dice. And it's like, wait a minute, that completely throws off the way how the pace of the game works. But for Candyland, it doesn't matter. Still kind of equally likely to win. So for that game, that's something where you can do those kinds of substitutions. I think it is actually very, very useful to be able to talk about this when it comes to the design of your own rules. It's useful to be able to talk with other designers. Say, like, here's this piece of information that we're storing early on, maybe we got cards that are flipped down, maybe we got cards we're putting in an envelope, maybe there's a quantity of things in a bag or something, and then you have to reach into it and pull things out, like it's Scrabble. Things that that sort of randomized in the back, the actual which one you're going to draw next from it is somewhat random based on some sort of probability, but then the probability of that could be public information, it could be hidden information. You might not know what was the distribution of stuff inside that bag to begin with. And that's why I want you to be able to use these words in describing how things are working in your own game to your own teammates, and especially to us. Because we want to understand what it is that you're trying to achieve with this bit of information. You know, hidden information typically is something that you're going to try to allow people to figure out over time. And there's a lot of stake over what that hidden piece of information is. Whereas there's not a whole lot of, you know, and it's kind of like shared among everybody who's looking at that piece of information. Whereas something that's random, it's usually kind of at that moment it's really important, and after that it's not so important anymore. It had some sort of consequence that might be recorded in the score, but it's not like from turn to turn to turn to turn that particular role or that particular spin was all that important. Private information and public information tend to be pretty easy to talk about, so they're just useful terms to people talk with, to be able to discuss with each other. And yeah, so I just want to introduce these terms. This is a taxonomy that was provided by C.L. Pierce. It sort of expands on the perfect and imperfect information, because imperfect information gets kind of fuzzy because it has all these different versions. And now that I think everybody who's planning on showing up today has shown up, we should probably start setting up for playtests. So is everyone sitting in your teams? I think everyone's more or less sitting where you were. All right. Any questions so far on other questions based on what I've been talking about? Have I clarified why I think these should be used differently? Okay. How many of you have changed your game mechanic, by the way? Yeah. What would you describe it as wrong?
Yeah, maybe deception.
It's deception?
It's not building.
It's not building. Okay. It's something like bluffing. Something like faking out your opponent. Okay. Everyone else still pretty much sticking with what you've got? Is yours still building?
You're building like
points, building sets and building a board.
Yeah, building a board. I haven't seen that part of the game yet.
Well, not building. You're building on the board. It's kind of what we've been thinking.
I think I need to just play your game to get that. Because it looked like a set collection game. All right. So, again, can I see which group has 2-player games? 1, 2, 3. Okay. And the rest, who has 4-player games? And yours has to be a 3-player game? Okay. All right. So, wait, hold on. Both of you are 2-player games. And did you play each other's games last time?
No.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. All right, then. Then that's easy. The two of you should be playing each other's games. Again, there should be observers who have recording material to be able to...
Is there a team of two?
Team of two with 2-player games. Yeah, no, like you don't play simultaneously.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, so that team comes over here, plays this game, then everybody here goes over there, plays that game.
Got it.
That's probably enough time for that.
Would it make sense to put all the 2-player games in one set of tables?
I think it would help if just the two of you just came up here, brought your game with you, and then you can just like hang out here. Because we're only going to end up playing one of, you know, either your team's game or their team at one time. We're not going to play both games simultaneously. The rest of you, let's see. How many of you have your game ready to go?
Wait, what was the question?
How many of you have your game ready to go? Okay. All right. I've played your game recently. You haven't.
I've not played this one. I played an old version of that one, and I played the one in the corner yesterday. I haven't played those two.
Okay.
Have
these two groups played each other's games yet? Okay,
you
have. Then what I'm going to suggest is that 3 people from this group come over here and play this game first. All right, and then Rick and I will join these two to play the middle game, and then the 4 of you will play their game.
Sweet.
All right.
Played their game already.
Oh, you already have?
Yeah.
Okay. I think we can. Like all 4 of you have played the same game.
Yeah.
Has it changed dramatically since the last time you played the game?
Not dramatically.
Not really.
Okay. How many tests of each game are we trying to get to?
At
least two playthroughs for each game?
Just one, actually.
Just one?
Was, yeah.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure after one, there'll be things to change.
Yeah.
And if we have time, maybe we can get one more.
Okay.
But
let me do a quick scan and see what other staff are available.
Okay.
Maybe we can get people outside of the
Let's see whether we can pull a few more people to play that game over there. All right, so let me just change this up then. Three of you come over here and play this game right now. Okay. For the presentation at the end of the of assignment one, I do want you to talk a little bit about your game, but don't explain the rules of your game during your presentation. That'll use up all the time that you've got. Talk about the process. Talk about what you started with, what you tried, what didn't work, and what kind of changes that make you make. You know, what worked and then how you rolled with it. I want to hear more about the story of how you got to where you are, because right after you do the presentation, we'll actually sit down and play each other's games, just like today, only it's not a play test, so you don't have to do like recording or anything. Everyone just plays games.
How long is the presentation?
I think it's only 5 minutes. I should be in the syllabus. I thought I wrote 5 minutes.
Okay, correct.
It's pretty fast. Yes, it doesn't have to be one of those like every single person in the team has to say something kind of thing. But if you want to organize it that way, you totally can. I just want to hear about what's the story of your game. The other thing is that I actually did look up the situation with Texas Hold'em, and I am going to reverse my position. That is actually not hidden information. And two things swayed me. One is I started discussing it with a bunch of other game designers online, and I discovered that there are a couple of variants of Texas Hold'em where you never deal the what they call the flop face down.
Oh, yeah,
you
yeah.
just
yeah.
play it face up one at a time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. At which point it's just a random deal from the top of the deck, and that makes it, and it's statistically the same either way, only this makes it very explicit, right? That is basically a random deal. So yes, that is in fact random. That's a very bad example to use for hidden information. Whereas the clue thing is, because the whole point of that game is that it gives you all these tools to be able to reveal this information. At a point of time when you put the cards inside, it is random. But then once it's inside there and the first turn starts, it's now hidden information. So okay, thank you very much. See you on Monday.